I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Ben Kay, and this is the Rugby Tonight podcast. This week, I'm joined by Brian O'Driscoll as we take stock at the halfway point to the European Rugby group stages. But before we get into the talking points from the weekend, here's a sneak peek of what else is coming up on the pod. Ali Eakin travelled up to Northampton to chat to Saints CEO Mark Darbin in the wake of Jim Mallander's leaving the club.
You know, clearly not a decision that was taken lightly. You know, Jim's overseen an amazing period of success for this club. He's well respected by players, by staff, by supporters, and so there is a sense of disappointment indeed.
And Welsh legend Adam Jones was our guest for the live studio show.
It might be time for a bit of fresh bread or get someone in to help him, maybe even if he's the boss, and get a new staff underneath him.
Now, the big result of the weekend saw Saracens hammered at home by Clermont in a game rearranged after being called off because of Sunday's snow. Before we discuss what's going on at Saracens, let's have a listen to an illuminating post-match interview from Mark McCall on Monday.
First defeat here, your first defeat in Europe since April 2015. That's a defeat here in Europe, that is. Heaviest defeat, and the last time you lost six in a row was 14 years ago. A pretty sobering defeat. How do you break that down?
Yeah, it's I didn't see that coming, to be honest. I think in the first 20 minutes, we it's our individual tackling, which was poor. Obviously, they've got some great athletes, and every time that we missed tackles, they got huge momentum and scored off the back of it. We had a bit of period of pressure ourselves the last 15 minutes of the first half, and weren't able to capitalise on that. But as you said, it's a sobering day for us.
You mentioned the missed tackles, 37. That's a number we just don't see from Saracens. Can you explain why?
Not really, and maybe a couple of individuals just come through a bit of confidence at the moment. But as a team, we've got all clearly got to do way better than that in such an important facet of the game against a team with the athletes and the danger they've got. And their tries didn't really come from big pressure moments. They came from sort of down short sides from 40 or 50 metres out, and people just missing tackles, and they got tries for nothing really, and we seemed to have to work very hard with the ball ourselves. So it was a day when we were well beaten by a much better team.
Can you identify the areas that you could change and fix ahead of the weekend?
Well, clearly on today's evidence, our defence is the number one priority, and probably our set piece as well. We had a number of line-outs close to their line and weren't able to capitalise on that. Our scrum was under pressure at various times today. So those three areas, yeah.
And on a more broader level, six defeats, is there anything on a more global level that's going wrong?
Well, up until today, the last couple of defeats have been by 1 point and 2 points. But we didn't see today coming, if I'm honest, and I'm not going to try and make any excuses for it.
Were you underprepared in any way, given perhaps, again, the situation that happened ahead of this game?
It didn't feel that way before the game, and it's easy to say after the game. We were just well beaten by a much better team in the day.
Mark, good man for talking to us. Thank you. Cheers.
So there you go, Drico. Fairly shell-shocked sounding Mark McCall.
It's new territory for them, isn't it? You know, is that six in a row now in all competitions?
Six in a row, yeah.
Like that's
and a really easy place to go and play next weekend. On the weekend coming up.
The only upside is that corresponding fixture coming so quickly is a positive from their perspective. Now, you know, you could look at it slightly differently in that, you know, they do have their injury concerns. They don't have their big names. They don't have Marrow. They don't have Billy, amongst, you know, a few others. So you still have to go to one of the strongholds of Europe and turn around a massive disappointment, you know, this from Monday. But the game is such a there's such a mental component to it that if you can get those top 3 or 4 inches right and get, you know, fix the few or plug the few holes that, you know, was more of a dam in the game on Monday, well, then you've got a fighting chance, but they're going to need to be sharp.
If they hadn't lost those Premiership games, no one would be talking about the Anglo-Welsh games, different sides that play in that. The Premiership games, they haven't been dreadful. It's not like we suddenly say, oh, what's happened to Saracens? Those Premiership games, the Gloucester one, they dominated the first half, just couldn't quite get over the line. The home side came back at the end. Harlequins the week before this, they actually did the typical Saracens thing of having no ball and still at the end of the game, right at the end of the game, being in a command, well, not commanding lead, but a lead that you thought they'd take over the line. Does the magnitude of this loss and the way it happened, does that take a little bit, is that more of a big thing for them? Is that air of invincibility that we've always had about Saracens starting to just break slightly?
Yeah, it's starting to eke away. It is. And that, you know, whatever about those close losses, because every side get, you know, you get a bit of luck and we're used to them getting into, you know, the business end of games, you know, towards the end and being a score up or score behind and just getting enough to get it done, even when they're off colour. Whereas, you know, that's they those results have gone against them in the Premiership recently and people can go accept that. But when you get embarrassed at home, and that's what it is when you concede 46 points. You have to remember too, they conceded a lot of points against Ospreys early on in round two as well. So in Allianz Park also. So it's, you know, there's definitely defensive deficiencies there. And you were there on Monday. So can that be solved in a week?
Yes, I think you can refocus it. Whether it can be solved in the long term, but I think you can get things right with your defence, because defence is quite simple, isn't it? It's not it's not like you've got no cut and thrust with your attack. Putting your defence is, or defence to me is about people getting excited about doing the boring things over and over again and not going off script.
Which is something that you would align Saracens with.
Yeah, one interesting thing, yeah. Alex Sanderson, who obviously is, as Ali Eakin pointed out during the commentary in his interview to him, which he didn't enjoy too much, he's in charge of defence. He actually said at the beginning of this season, we had the best defence by a country mile in the Premiership last year. Perhaps we spend too long looking at the defence and we need to dedicate a bit of that time to improving our attack. So there has been a bit of a sea change that you wonder whether now they'll revert back to type a little bit and tighten everything up.
And do you really see now this weekend what the Saracens team is truly made of?
But
yes,
they're back-to-back
European champions, but when your back is against the wall, when now this, does this become a must-win game for them? Because, you know, Clermont will have one foot in the quarterfinal if they get a positive result. Particularly if they can deny Sarri's any points as they did on Monday in Allianz Park.
It's a huge game. I don't think they can afford to call it a must-win game internally, because going to the Stade Marcel Michelin as a must-win game, otherwise your season's done, is very, very a tough ask. But there's almost nothing to lose for them, and whether they can call on that strength of confidence that they've had in previous years to dig out what would be a monumental win. You know, anyone who hasn't been to that stadium just can't understand what the atmosphere is like.
They still have 10 points. Mm. You know, if they can manage to get something out of this game, 11 points, you know, with one home fixture remaining. I'm trying to think off the top of my head who their away game. So the Ospreys away.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's not beyond the realms of possibility, particularly the way Ospreys have been playing, that they could go and get a result there. Maybe in a really good day, they could get 5 points. So they could still get to 2021 as a second place team, you know, theoretically losing this weekend. So it's, to your point, it's not do or die, but it's starting to get into that conversation, which is a first for Saracens for a long time.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one of the difficult things for them, as you said, is they've never been cut apart like that before. Now, they can maybe blame that on the delays and the Monday night, but there was they were easy pickings on Monday night. So if they don't, they then go to a reasonably tough game of in the Premiership of Leicester away at Welford Road, and you know usually they'd go there with no fear at all. But if they were off the back of seven losses, that's that you know then suddenly it starts to spiral, doesn't it? And you get into a rut you can't get out of.
You tighten up and. Yeah, you start getting very result orientated rather than, you know, and they've been always all season, every time I've listened to an interview, it's talking about them improving on their previous game and improving on previous seasons, which have been on of a very high standard. So when there's a little bit of a rut, you need a win. So all of a sudden, does your tack change or you do become a little bit results focused?
Yeah, one thing out of that game that needs mentioning is the performance of Raka on the wing. Scored three tries himself, set up potentially the try of the season where he's just carved everyone else up and then offloaded to Flip van der Merwe. He'll get all the glory.
It was like a slow-mo. It was actually like a slow-mo. You knew the steps were coming.
Yeah.
You know, left foot chop, and there was nothing. Was it Spencer got done inside and then one or two others. It was an exceptional try.
And we might see him playing for France in the Six Nations. He's qualified, I think, come then. Project player. Should we not start argument? Not a bad project player.
Yeah, all right, decent.
But I guess the fact that we were probably all banking on the fact that Saracens might stop the rut or the glut of bad results for Premiership sides, not one win in the European Champions Cup. So
that's a pretty amazing stat, and you look at some of the results. It was a lot of teams playing away from home. Bath were away from home. Wasps away from home. So some tough games. But you would have anticipated the likes of Northampton playing at home, the position that they're in. They needed a win, and they got ripped apart. And then the one fallback we all felt was that Saracens, could change all that, and at least it would be one win for the Premiership teams. But it wasn't to be, and. It's pretty remarkable. I'm not sure if it's happened in the past.
I don't think it has.
I have a feeling maybe a couple of seasons ago there might have been five of six, but I don't know if it's seven from seven.
Yeah.
Do you know what it creates? So much conversation. Oh, is the Premiership overrated? And then I saw Andy Good making reference to all of the Pro 14 teams just focus on Europe, and the Pro 14 is secondary to their thoughts, and they're able to rest all their players. And listen, there's all.
You never rested.
No. I played an awful lot of times for my province, in every ground going. So the thing on it is, yes, we are protected a little bit more in Ireland in particular, and obviously with the dual contracts in Wales, and now likewise with Scotland. But the reality is that Irish teams, particularly in the Pro 14 or in the Celtic League as it was known, have still had a massive involvement over the course of the last 16 or 17 years. I think it's 16 years. And someone made a point that since 2001, 9 Irish teams have won the Celtic League and 11 times have been losing finalists. So that's pretty consistent in both competitions.
Yeah.
I think people are questioning the strength of it, but there's no doubt the top teams in the Pro 14 are of a high standard and could compete at the very highest level at the Premiership, and I think that's the argument right now.
So if it's not the difference in league, what is it just an anomaly that all the English teams have lost, and that that can happen. It's a good chance for it happening. One thing that Matt O'Connor has been really really vocal about, the standard of refereeing, I thought is a brilliant response from Johan van Graam straight afterwards when he heard, and he just said, well, actually, we just adapted to the way the game was refereed better, which is 100% right. There is a slight argument that the Premiership referees at the breakdown have been so or become so obsessed with quick ball that they don't let teams get away. They almost coach on the field. Now get your hands away. And it's very, very quick. Do you think that perhaps the Premiership clubs have become almost forgotten how to clear out a tough breakdown because they don't get enough practice of it in their league?
Maybe so, but you know, and I'm sure you know, particularly probably in your, you know, in your latter years of your career, you analyse the opposition, but you analyse the referee too. So in advance of knowing what the referee's hot on or what they're going to let go a little bit, you do that planning the week of a game. So it shouldn't come as a huge shock or surprise that the French referees will let the ruck be a bit more of a mess and there'll be a bit more of a contest. Whereas judging on how the Premiership referees have adjudicated this season, they want it all for the attacking team. So, you know, I think it's potentially a little bit of a cop-out in that, oh, you know, we've been dealing with, you know, one set of rules or one type of adjudication for the season and now we found something different. You know Europe's coming. You know the individual and what they're really, you know, what their likes and dislikes are. So you have to be able to see that in advance. And even if it doesn't throw up what you've planned for during the week, you have to have that adaptability to react 10 or 15 minutes into a game when a few decisions have gone against you.
Now, you were at Thurman Park. You saw the Munster-Leicester performance. I know you were a bit surprised by how poor Leicester were. If you were Matt O'Connor now, what would you be saying to your team ahead of the home game? Or what do you expect to change?
I think the one disappointing thing for me, and we talked about it in commentary, was that I thought the collision winning was all won by Munster. I think the fight in the tackle, particularly when carrying the ball for Leicester, was pretty disappointing. I think that ruck can be made an awful lot easier when you give a clearer target. I thought the fight on the ground was almost non-existent.
Yeah.
They were willing to take the contact rather than, you know, getting an extra yard. And we all know what an extra yard can do. It makes defensive lines, you know, shift back on their heels rather than on their toes. It doesn't allow that first man in to get in and poach or into that jackal position. And you're entitled to that extra role. You know, it's like that, you know, fish out of water. You're entitled to fight, you know, provided you don't do a couple of rotations. I saw none of that. I thought they conceded and just allowed themselves to be dictated by Munster. And conversely, I thought the fight of Munster and the targeting of the at the ruck time as to where exactly the clear out needed to take place was so evident, and fast ruck ball creates a considerably easier game than having to wait for 4 or 5 seconds on rucks because defensive line set.
I totally agree with that. It'd be interesting, Matt O'Connor saying to the Leicester Mercury this week that potentially Manu Tuilagi, we might see him if he gets through this week's training. Matt Tamu is not too far away. I just wonder whether they'll almost gamble a little bit the fact that they haven't had a lot of game time and throw those guys back in. Also, Palotta now has arrived, which would give them a little bit more go forward as well. Logo Mulapola, we saw his first game for a long time. But that's I agree with that's what they need. They just didn't have that ability to win that collision and knock Munster back. And when they've got like Peter Romani and you know, all those
and
other
Stander, guys. Do you know what? In fairness to Callum Foney, boy, did he try. Oh. And he carried an incredible amount, but he
can't
was,
do it on,
he
your
was
own,
on his own.
And that's the other thing, actually, that Leicester never tipped the ball on once. So if the all forward carriers are just carrying off nine as a one without sort of looking to pass either way, you can be gang tackled.
Just looking at that game, because Leicester started it quite well the first 5 or 6 minutes. They looked as though they had that nice pod set up, you know, three forwards with George Ford out the back, and they went to him a couple of times and they got that width. Where Munster are particularly impressive on their press isn't really at 1, 2 and 3 from the ruck. It's actually 3, 4 and 5. Yeah. So if you're willing to stretch it to put yourself under a bit of pressure at 5th and 6th defender, they have to get very soft because you get vulnerable out there.
Yeah. Well, we'll see what happens anyway. That old game obviously is at Welford Road. Just picking a couple of the others out. Bath came really close to turning over Toulon, away in Toulon. Chris Ashton, 50p-foot kick.
I feel for him because I've had one or two of those in my career.
And perfectly placed.
It was it was bad. Listen, he was put in a bad spot.
Yeah.
And then he compounded the issue with, you know, the slice of all slices. So
John Bath will fancy that.
They really will. I think Toulon, you know, I've seen a good bit of them this season. They, you know, we talk about Saracens losing their mystique I definitely think Toulon have lost theirs. I think they look like a very different team, not being navigated the same way as they were with Johnny Wilkinson and with Guido in particular. They still haven't found who their perfect 10 are. Do they want to go with Bello, you know, who came off the bench and won the game for them? I don't think they really know how they want to, you know, to play and you know what players they want to utilize. So I fancy that Bath will have enough for them there, provided you know they can stay in the game like they have, like they've shown. And they scored a couple of cracking tries themselves down in Toulon.
I think for me, just the last one to pick out in the next round, because we're at halfway stage, is your old team Leinster going to Sandy Park. That is a hugely impressive performance by them, and probably the most disappointing one out of all of the. I know Leicester got thumped, and you know Northampton would have thought they should have won at home, but Exeter are flying high in the Premiership. They've opened up a gap, and the game almost seemed to be their sort of rugby. It wasn't the most open, expansive game, and we've seen them with that pick-and-go game before being able to get over the line.
Which, for me, makes it more all the more impressive, because Leinster didn't play their normal game. They like to play a bit like the Chiefs. They want to play expansive. You see, they score a huge amount of their tries from their own half, even from their own 22. They're a wide team, playing lots of phases. But we saw them getting through an incredible amount of phases by that pick and jam game, and we touched on it in the studio on Sunday. Sometimes, if you know tactically, you can turn things on their head. Why do certain teams adapt a particular style of play? Because they know it's difficult to defend against. So if you flip it on its head, why not go after a side that loves to do a particular style, because they too will know it's difficult to defend. Yeah. And that's why I think Leinster went and identified, you know, maybe they don't love defending those pick and jams in the close quarters.
Yeah.
And huge credit, being able to go through, I think, you know, there were two sequences where there was 35 phases and then 44 phases for that Jack Conan try. But also for me, the impressive part was they were still able to close the game out brilliantly. You know, to win without conceding a losing bonus point. Those moments are huge, because now Leicester Exeter have to go over to the Aviva, which isn't an easy place to go and play, and probably play one of their better games of the season. So, yeah, it's very interesting viewing.
Yeah, we'll learn a lot more about Exeter Chiefs and their European ambitions this weekend. The other big news this week saw Saints part way with long-serving director of rugby Jim Mallander. And in the wake of his dismissal, we sent Ali Eakin up to Northampton to talk to the CEO, Mark Darbin.
A bleak midwinter scene at Franklin's Gardens. The first day here in more than a decade without Jim Mallander at the helm. He brought this club enormous success, promotion from the Championship, four major trophies. But since that Premiership win 3.5 years ago, they've been on the slide. And after that disappointment, the latest in a long line of disappointments against the Ospreys on the weekend, he was given his marching orders yesterday.
You know, clearly not a decision that was taken lightly. You know, Jim's overseen an amazing period of success for this club. He's well respected by players, by staff, by supporters. And so there is a sense of disappointment indeed.
Was there ever a suggestion that some of the other coaches might have gone ahead of Jim Mallander himself?
We felt that making change at the top of the tree from a rugby perspective was the right thing to do. And you know, now we're getting behind our existing set of coaches, trying to create the right conditions for them to succeed.
If I was to throw a few names at you, Mike Ford is available. As I understand it, he wants to be coaching. Wayne Smith from New Zealand. The likes of Ali Hefa, who would be presumably quite high on your list, having been a former Saints man. Those kind of characters are what you'd be looking for?
We're right at the start of the process. You know, we haven't spoken to anyone directly as yet. There are a lot of very, very good coaches that are being linked with the role, as you would expect. So early days.
Nick Beale, as I understand it, is the only one with rugby experience on the board. Are you content that you have the necessary knowledge to make that right call?
I'm confident we've got the right capability at board level to make a final decision. I also think we'd be very foolish not to tap into the amazing Saints family that we have. And indeed, I think we'd be foolish to not solicit a perspective from our senior playing group, you know, with people like Dylan and Rob Horn and Tom Wood and you know, many others. The list could go on and on.
Are you ready for this to get worse before it gets better, potentially?
I think we're in a challenging situation, and our focus is climbing back up the table in the Aviva Premiership. But I'm confident it's the right choice, and I can assure you that everyone here at the club is focused on turning things around.
So 10 years, it's a decade with one club is impressive by any standards. You look at the longest reigning coaches, probably Guy Novez, 17-18 season before he took over the French job from Toulouse, before he got the boot from them as they were on the decline. Do you think Jim potentially overstayed his time there? He obviously peaked in 2014. They've been probably in reverse the last couple of seasons. It can't just be his issue, though. There's got to be a wider component to this as well.
Yeah, look, I think Northampton Saints will always be grateful to Jim Mallander for getting that Premiership title, apart from anything else, but all the other things that he achieved. And there were times where they played some fantastic rugby, and I think that has been the hard thing. Once you hit those heights and your fans are used to that sort of performance, when it tails off, as it has done for, let's be honest, at least the last couple of years, they're disappointed, and their expectations have been made higher than that. I do think you either have to be an exceptional coach or a brilliant presenter, or you have to be a fantastic delegator for you to be able to last a long time in a coaching job, because the same old messages, if you keep even that same presenter style, almost, I've been in teams where players have been playing whatever the coach's name bingo is. If you're used to hearing the same terminology used over and over again, it just loses that impact. And sometimes just bringing that fresh blood in can automatically have a response because it feels new and it feels exciting.
Do you think that the credit in the bank accumulated from 2014 and some of that great stuff gave him that extra length at the other end?
Yeah, I do. I think there was an element that he had signed a four-year contract, and we know that Northampton made a loss last year for the first time in a while. Now rugby clubs aren't flush with money, despite what is sometimes written about the Premiership teams, and you have to manage your budget. And teams, if someone's a very well played director of rugby and he's got a couple of years, it's going to cost you a fair amount of money to change that coaching setup. So that does play a part in it. Did he oversell? I think the thing was, they had a couple of years just before the two seasons where they really flew and they got to the Premiership final 2 years running. They had had a little bit of a, well, are they ever going to get anywhere? And a couple of people were saying, is it time for Jim Mallander to move on? And he proved them wrong. He had that bounce back and those great couple of years. And then certainly that gave him some time in the bank, because, and rightly so, if you achieve something like that, then you deserve to be rewarded for it with both loyalty and a new deal. But it just makes it really difficult, because even if Jim Mallander wanted to walk away, what you've got to remember is, if you walk away, you don't necessarily get that big payout, and he's got to look after his family. So I almost feel that they got a little bit stuck in that rut of, well, we can't afford.
Who goes first?
Can't afford to get rid of you, and you can't afford to walk away. Now, I'm sure he won't. He won't have been thinking exactly like that, and maybe Northampton weren't either. But also, the longer you leave it, you lose that ability to plan. So now we're stuck with a situation where, who's available to come and take over? Now, Alan Dickinson, the attack coach, is going to take over. We hear with the coaches that sat under Jim as a team. So again, how much changes with that, because it's the same minds in that coaching room together without Jim Mallander there.
How much onus is on the players when a coach has to walk like that? They haven't really delivered as a collective themselves as well.
No.
And you look back to some of the internationals returning, maybe haven't been at their best for club, playing considerably better for England than they have for Northampton, maybe with the exception of Courtney Laws.
There's a huge onus on the players. There always is an onus on the players. From the business perspective and from the decision-making perspective, you can't sack all your players at once. You can't just go, oh, all right, well, it's not the players aren't performing. So you have to try a different method, which is, well, let's see if someone else who's in charge of bringing those players together and getting them united as a team to go out, you know, maybe that's the area, that's the easiest area to change, is it? Doesn't matter that it will, you know, whether or not it changes overnight, I still think that's the right way to go. The other thing is that as director of rugby, which is different to a head coach, it is your responsibility to put together that team. So you might have been restricted by the amount of budget you've got to spend or whether players want to come and play for you. I think they were hurt by Louis Picamoles, who came in and was fantastic for them, but then wanted to leave very quickly, although they got a big remuneration for his services being taken away and compensated for that. It's still, you did feel that he was the sort of player you could build a team around, and other players would want to come and play for your club to play alongside him. That's one reason I know that Leicester were really keen to get George Ford, was that other players wanted to play with him. Ben Youngs wants to play with him. Johnny May has come to Leicester because he wants to play with George Ford. So that there are certain players that can do that. I feel sorry for Jim Mallander, but I don't think he'll be out of a job for very long because there aren't that many good or that many experienced directors of rugby around at the moment. And, you know, that's probably the thing with Saints. Who do they look at? You'd know more about this. Stuart Lancaster's just signed a new deal with Leinster. He's one of the names that has come up.
And I think Stuart wants, you know, I get the impression he wants his time away from England. He's done a phenomenal job at Leinster. I think it's been a joint production between Leo Cullen and himself. I don't think it's fair to, you know, heap all the praise on Stuart, but he's come in and do you know what he's done? He's gone back and done what he loves doing, and that's coaching. You know, the director of rugby, even though I don't think Leo Cullen, that is his role, I think he's still a head coach, but he does a lot of the director of rugby work, the contracts behind the scenes, all the media stuff. Stuart is, you know, obviously has to do a small bit of that, but front and center of his role is to go out and coach the team. And I've only heard good reports from all the players. So, you know, will he get swayed by a lucrative contract? I get the impression that he's happy where he is and that he's, you know, he's going to stay put for another couple of years yet.
Another one's Richard Cockerell, who has obviously gone up to Edinburgh after Leicester and him parted company. Again, a guy who's signed a contract, so, you know, he might feel that he has to, you know, you don't want to be seen as a guy that jumps ship, but equally, I don't know legally where he stands, whether he might have to stay out there. Mike Ford's another one that has been mentioned. And he's probably the only one that there wouldn't be too many legal challenges because he is working as DOR of a Dallas team that's joining the Major League Rugby, but you'd think he'd be able to come back.
And what about, you know, the left fielders? We've heard Jordan Murphy's name being thrown in the mix for Cardiff. Yeah. I don't know whether we've heard the end of that, but I suppose he's got some currency now. He is being touted as a first team coach, and that's sometimes maybe he doesn't go for the, you know, for the first job that his name is thrown up for. But yeah, you know, another one that comes along. He's now in. He's got his name in that hat.
You have to think of it as the opportunity that's there and you know, what players you got to work with. Can I improve them? Because the last thing you want to do is move and become the number one and the performances aren't great and then your reputation is, well, he's not a number one, he's a number two, obviously. There's another guy that actually, I think Northampton will be kicking themselves that they ever let him go, and that's Ali Heifer, who's Exeter's attack coach, because he's a local Northampton lad. He played his rugby at Northampton. But try going to him now when you've got a senior role at Exeter, you're very, very highly regarded, and saying, do you want to come and work with this team instead that are right down at the bottom of the table, and these are the contracts these are the players that signed up for this long, or do you want to stay for a team that's seemingly going that way still
and also with, you know, who has a director of rugby that maybe has eyes on the English job in a couple of years' time when Eddie Jones is done with England post Japan? You know, does Rob Baxter move into an England role? And so is there something bigger in Exeter for Ali Heifer? It's a good argument,
but I'm sure Northampton will be scouring the world. It won't just be England that they're looking at. There'll be looking at some of the Southern Hemisphere coaches as well. So one to keep our eye on. Just another point of business is Talupe Faletau and his injury. Nasty injury. We've seen a few nasty injuries this weekend. Talusa Veanu broke his jaw in two places as well, so he's out for at least 8 weeks. But Faletau, from a Wales perspective, hugely damaging because, well, actually, if you look at the three best number eights in the world, they're all out injured at the moment. Billy Vunipola, obviously Talupe Faletau, and
Kieran Reid.
Yeah, name slipped my mind. But Kieran Reid's having a back operation. He's out for 4 months.
Faletau, massive loss, you know, particularly with the news that Sam Warburton's looking as though he's going to miss the Six Nations too. I thought Faletau, in advance of the Lions tour, I thought Billy Vunipola had to be fit for the Lions to be competitive. He didn't go. And I thought Toby Faletau was absolutely immense. His work rate and what he brings you of guaranteeing advantage line, you know, when he carries the ball, you just can't legislate for that as an attacking weapon. So for them to lose him and his experience, even though he's not a huge talker, a very quiet guy, I think when you look at a team sheet and you see Toby Faletau or Talupe Faletau on it, you feel the better for it and you feel we've got a fighting chance here. So a massive loss for Bath and for Wales, obviously.
Do you think there's anything in... Now, Eddie Jones has been quite vocal about his autumn selection policy, and part of that, he said, was down to reintegrating the Lions boys back into the England environment. And also, you know, one of the things, he didn't just let them have a rest when he didn't play them. He actually worked them harder because he felt they'd almost got deconditioned just because they'd got into that rut of a long, long season. Having experienced that, is there anything in that? Do you think some of these injuries might be caused by the Lions trip or?
There's always that conversation where you do see, you know, when there are increased numbers after a Lions tour, increased numbers of injuries, you know, the finger pointing automatically comes out at the Lions. I think in some cases it's unlucky. I think it's more relevant to form.
I totally agree.
And it's impossible to keep yourself at that level. And I think you can get unlucky with injury, but I think you're more susceptible to a fall in form because you've peaked during the summer. It's one of the events of your rugby career, if you're lucky enough to go on one, and then you come home, you know, you sit on a beach for a month, and then you do pre-season, and it's a short pre-season straight into games. I just think it's very difficult to constantly keep yourself on a high and a level, you know, where it's expected of you, particularly if you've played well during the summer. So I don't buy into the injury aspect.
I agree, because we'd be looking surely more at strains and muscular. If you look at how Talupe Faletau got injured, it wasn't exactly like he was running across the field on his own with no one around him. Right, let's turn our attention to the Champions Cup then, and ahead of Harlequin's trip to Ulster this weekend, Welsh legend Adam Jones joined us in the studio for Rugby Tonight. Here are the best bits of our chat with him.
Okay, we've got loads of questions in, Freddie, haven't we?
Adam, this is your life. so let's have a look at the first question people want to know. The Paul Williams, as the game develops, you think props will get lighter or heavier?
I think they're going to get fitter and a little bit less body fat than certain people on, especially me.
Well, I was going to say you're wearing skinny ripped jeans, so I reckon they're getting lighter.
I'm in London now, so I
Is that a Welsh thing, is it?
This is how we dress.
Jeans. Skinny ripped jeans.
When we come to London, this is how we think.
Yanto. At Yanto, how much do you bench press?
That's strong Ian Evans, like a ball.
Ian Evans,
second row.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
A lot more than him, yeah. Not much anymore, though. I just don't do much weights anymore, really.
How much do you bench press,
though? How much do I bench press? Yeah. I don't bench press very much.
Okay. I see this guy do a fair bit in the gym before. He was quite impressive.
Yeah. Thank you.
Full little fella.
Thank you.
There we go. Who's the most skillful player you've ever played with?
Justin Tipperick, probably, as a forward.
Oh, that's got to be wounding, hasn't it? That's got to be absolutely killing.
What?
Most skillful player, is that not you?
I thought it was going to be Gav Henson.
In the back's probably Shane. Tommy Bow was good. Right?
Jeez, Tommy will be delighted to hear that. I'm shocked to hear that.
What about you two?
Most skillful.
Most skillful player you play with.
Depends what you mean by skill.
Ethan Asiwa.
So if you include footwork, Jason Robinson was the player that I always think we'll never see someone quite like him again. I don't think, just because he was pretty small. I mean, I suppose it's a little bit similar to Shane Williams.
Yeah, yeah.
But when he got caught behind you, you could hear 80,000 people sudden intake of breath, and you knew that he'd. Usually, when the fullback counter attacks as front five forwards, you panic a little bit and you think we're never going to get there in time. But he'd always stay on his feet long enough for you to get there.
So,
great.
Interesting.
Let's have a look. Do you think there should be a scrum referee? Would you like to see more ex forwards refereeing? That's quite a good one.
Yeah, I think I do think refs should be upskilled. They do, they do. They spend more time with props. They spend, I think, Carl Dixon, who's with us and knows he said forwards aren't fit enough to be refs, which is a fair point because you know they're only they're not big guys, they're refs. So I think it's hard to get it at both sides because it could be a totally different thing happening.
How much has it improved over the last few years? We're seeing less resets, but not necessarily that they're trying to get the ball out quicker, which I think the rest of us are probably quite glad about. But are the props?
I think it's like just coaching the scrum. Now you realise it's. Last year, you had the referee had to decide when the ball had to come in. Now that doesn't happen. And that's made it a lot better for every team, every side. Because it's on your tap, it's on your strike. And so it's not relying on a guy who's never been in there to manage it for you.
And obviously something that I want to know the answer to, how do you maintain such a natural-looking perm?
good question, yeah.
Do you put anything on it?
There's no greys.
There's no greys.
No?
Just for men?
It's a little bald on top. No, I just brush it every now and again, wash it, you know, condition it. Mane and tail is a good one.
It's the same with your hair, right? You barely do anything to it.
No. OK, we got one there.
The bottom one's good.
Yeah,
the bottom one's good.
Is it time... it's a cool ball. Is it time for Gatland to leave Wales?
Ooh. He's been there a long time, hasn't he?
Does that mean yes?
Yeah. I don't know. Look, I didn't finish in the way I wanted to, and it's very bitter. You know, we've both on this panel...
Leave me out of this. we're great mates.
Had a run-ins with Gats and been dropped, or not picked rightly or wrongly. But, look, I think it might be time for a bit of fresh bread or get someone in to help him, even if he's the boss, and get a new staff underneath him.
You supporting the new style of rugby? Wales look like they're trying to play now, though, this autumn?
Yeah.
Will it take a bit of time,
Yeah, I think, you know, I was a massive fan of the way we always played. You know, getting on the corner, it was easy enough for front five forward.
Yeah.
It was a lot of hard work, but, you know...
Enjoyed it.
But you knew your role, so it's going to take a bit of bedding in. And, you know, the way we did try to play in the autumn is quite positive. So, yeah, it was nice to see a bit more offloading. You know, Rob Evans has come to the fore. He's been, you know, we've had Geth for so long, and now Rob's kind of come in because Geth's been injured, and he looked like a sort of pushing on, definitely international quality prop.
Right, Brian, before the tournament started on this pod, you and Lawrence almost did your pre-tournament predictions and who was going to qualify from each group. Are you confident that they're all going to stay the same if we run through them now?
I'm confident we're pool one, but thereafter we'll have to wait and see. I think we've done a reasonable job. I don't think we didn't put ourselves out there too much. I think we went with the staples and didn't think that there was going to be that much of a turn up for the books. Other than, you know, the in pool one, the inaugural European Champions Cup for La Rochelle, and we thought that with their home form and their form in the top 14 last year and the squad that they've built and the mentality that they've built, I think we felt as though they were going to be a force to be reckoned with in that pool, and thankfully we were right.
And the other two teams in that pool that obviously have been playing each other back to back is Ulster and Harlequins. Surprising that Ulster got the victory away at the Stoop, or are Harlequins just a little bit off the pace?
I think they're off the pace. Obviously, they'd lost the first two, so they were all but out of it, particularly with La Rochelle having maximum points after two and now, you know, maximum points after three. You get the sense from an Ulster perspective that it would be good for them, for La Rochelle to run away with this pool, that realistically they've got to be looking at a better second place finish rather than winning the pool themselves. They do have La Rochelle back in Belfast in round five. But first and foremost, they've got to beat Quinns in the return fixture with 5 points this weekend. That would get them up to 13 after four rounds with all to play for. So in reality, they're going to need to win all three, but two of those games are at home. So it's not unthinkable that, that Ulster could still qualify at 19, 20 points.
Well, we'll see how Ulster get on this weekend. That game's live on BT Sport 2 and 4K UHD on Friday night from 7pm. But for now, you're just going to stick with Stade La Rochelle?
Yeah. I think potentially it could be just them coming out of that pool because they could still go to Belfast and get a victory themselves. Yeah. If they win this weekend in Coventry and then go and win in Belfast, that is going to be them qualifying on their own. Okay. They'll put pay to anyone else. So potentially you're looking at just one team coming out of that group.
Okay, pool two, I don't think we would have thought at this stage with the last match that we were talking about earlier on that Clermont would be looking like they're running away with it slightly. There's still the Ospreys have got an opportunity on 8 points, Saracens on 10 points and Clermont Auvergne on 14, Northampton way back on 1 point, so we'd think they're out of it. You said beforehand, you and Lawrence, that Saracens and Clermont would qualify. Do you still think that they both will?
Probably, but not definitely. You look at Ospreys are in a good spot now. You know, they're on, is it 8 points they're on? So, you know, they get a bonus point against Northampton at home this weekend, 13, and they still have to play Saracens in Swansea. So yeah, that's that becomes an enormous game. I fancy Saracens to potentially turn around. I know not many sides go to Marcel Michelin and get a win there, but I just think they're the sort of team to react on a big stage when their backs are against the wall, and they'll be fed up that, you know, six losses in a row, this isn't us, this isn't the new Saracens. So I think they'll run Clermont pretty close, if not pip them this weekend and get them right back in the mix.
Well, as Brian was saying, that's one of the closest pulls. I'll be over in Clermont Auvergne, experiencing the atmosphere of the Yellow Army. That's on Sunday at 3pm on BT Sport 2. So you can catch up with that one there, but also on BT Sport 3 and 4K UHD is the Ospreys against Northampton game. That's Sunday at 3pm as well. So take your pick of those two games. Pool 3, Leinster and or Montpellier to qualify was your pre-tournament prediction.
Yeah, pretty harsh on Exeter, considering they were, you know, reigning Premiership champions. Obviously, they started the tournament with two wins, not getting a bonus point in either. But with Leinster are in the driving seat now. They're in great shape. Three wins out of three, 14 points, and sitting pretty. But we did say that this was the pool of death. We did say that, you know, lots of teams would win their home games, and picking the odd away win, you know, that's what Leinster have managed to do. They've gone away from home twice now and beaten both Glasgow and Exeter. So only Montpellier to go on the road to. They'll fancy them their chances at home in the Aviva this coming weekend against Exeter, which is live on BT, and then in round six against Glasgow when they have nothing to play for. So I think Leinster are in fantastic position, just a matter of whether Montpellier can get themselves a second place finish.
Yeah, and that Leinster-Exeter game, Saturday, 2:45pm, BT Sport 2. Just one quick question about Leinster. If they do win their first five games, would they be the sort of team that wanted to finish as high as possible in their last game, or might they make some changes to look after some of their bodies there?
Good question. You see, the thing is, and to Andy Goode's point, you know, they'll be given a rest week after that in advance of going into Six Nations. So I wouldn't envisage seeing a second string team. You have to look at it as well. you can't take liberties and you can't take a risk that you're not in the top four seeds. Obviously, you want to get that home quarter final. So if there's any chance where a shock away victory would put you down in fifth or sixth or seventh or eighth position, I think you can't take that risk. And I think they'll be trying to go for the jugular. You know, is it a bit of an ask to expect them to go away to Montpellier and get a win? I think if you get a losing bonus point there, that's a great result. But you're looking to pick up five from your final home game against Glasgow.
Yeah, we don't know. Montpellier could be out of it by then as well. So good opportunity to go over there, get that big result. And nice to hear that they might get a rest the week after. You obviously won't be having a rest. You never rest, do you?
Never.
Never rest. Never. Never rest. Well done. Pool four, Brian and Lawrence's pre-tournament prediction, Munster and Leicester to qualify. Is that still the case?
Oh, I don't know. That is such an evenly contested pool. Cast have even thrown themselves into the mix on 7 points. I just wonder, is this the other group where you only get one team coming out of? And obviously Munster are brilliantly positioned to achieve that. But, they've got to go to Leicester and get more than a losing bonus point. They've got to go and win. And if so, I think that could be commanding enough for them just to be the sole recipient of topping that pool.
Yeah, the only group where no team has won all its games so far. So you've got Munster on 11 points, Castor on 7, Racing 92 on 6 and Leicester on 6. So I think you're right. I think that might be one team. And bonus points then become very important, don't they? So Munster picking up that bonus point last week, hugely important. But you will be able to see the return leg at Welford Road. That's Leicester Tigers against Munster Sunday at 5:15 on BT Sport 2 and 4K UHD. Last one then, pool five. You both thought that Scarlets and Toulon might qualify. Bath nearly put a spanner in those works last week, but what do you think at the moment?
I think Bath are in a great spot now. I'm going to break from our pre-tournament thoughts on this one, and I'm going to go with Toulon and Bath as the two qualifiers from that group. I think, again, Bath have two home games. They have Scarlets back in the rec in January. They've got Toulon this coming weekend, which is going to be an enormous game from them, not only from the point of qualifying, but an opportunity for them to leapfrog Toulon and become the number one pick from this pool. So, Scarlets, I suppose, a bit disappointing early on in the pool stages. They didn't show that end-of-season form that won them the Pro 14 last year, or Pro 12 as it was. But they are still in the mix themselves. They have an awful lot of work to do.
They were lucky, weren't they, to get out of jail. I say lucky, two brilliant bits of skill, but they looked like they were going down at home to Benetton.
Huge credit to Benetton, They could have felt sorry for themselves losing Minto after 25 minutes. So to play, 55 minutes, and 50 of those you were right in the game and looked as though you were gonna take the glory. But a good side stay in it till the end, and two late scores was enough for Scarlets, and huge relief. But they still have to go and get it done in Benetton this weekend, and we've seen how Toulon struggled. Could be sure when Bath go there that they won't find it easy. They're a different prospect, Benetton, in Italy this year.
Well, that's the roundup of all the European games to look forward to this weekend at the halfway point of the back-to-back rounds 3 and 4. Thanks for listening to the Rugby Tonight podcast. Hopefully you've enjoyed it, and hopefully you'll enjoy another packed weekend of European rugby on BT Sport 2. We're back next week with special guest Ellis Genge joining us in the studio for Rugby Tonight, so be sure to tune in at the usual time on a Wednesday. Remember to subscribe to the pod so it's delivered straight to your device every Thursday. If you've enjoyed listening today, please give Brian a 5-star rating and a nice review on iTunes. Bye for now.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc. Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.